Good morning. Sorry for the delay, but I think you'll find that it's going to be a very informative morning, and it's worth your while to be here. I'm Gene Lozano, and I'm the chair of the Committee on Access and Transportation. And to my left is Bernice Kandarian, the president of the California Council of Citizens with Low Vision. And I'm going to see first if Bernice would like to make any opening comments, and then I'll make a few comments and then introduce our first speaker, who is immediately to my right. Bernice?
I have a microphone.
You got a mic?
Yes, I
go
do.
Go for it.
Oh. Good morning and welcome, everyone. Gene has put together a very informative and important meeting today, and I hope that when you leave that you will assist the organization in looking out for our interests in the kinds of things that are coming in the environment that are going to be difficult for us.
Okay, thank you. As you know, that we're being streamed, and for those who are listening, if you would like to access the program, please go to. I'm going to give you the how you can get the program from the CCB website, and go the backslash the three W's dot CCBnet dot org / conventions / CON 13 program. So that's where you get the program for this breakout session, as well as all the other breakout sessions and the general sessions, and finally the business session. So you can find out what's going on. And if you are an ACB leader on the list, they also put the program. It will be archived. This is being recorded, and some of the general sessions, business session will also be recorded, and I believe the banquet. So there'll be several things. Unfortunately, not everything will be streamed because we are just streamed in this room. We don't have the technology yet. Maybe down the road for other rooms. So. But it would be in the archives, yes. Okay. Those of you seen the program, you will see that we're going to have a many diverse things to do with access. And we're going to be talking about technology later on, the elevator, future and current elevator technology. We're going to learn about high-speed rail, and also governmental entities that are working on access. And we're going to learn about the California Commission on Disability Access. But right now, an issue that is of great importance to all of us is information, accessible information to the labeling of prescriptions. And we're very fortunate that within our organization that we not only have the past president of the council who's had this interest, but also the current president of the American Council of the Blind, Mitch Pomerantz, who is going to be giving us an update on accessibility to prescription drugs labeling after, and this is the efforts after the passage of the Safety and Innovation Act, that the FDA Act. And Mitch, if you would please enlighten us on what is happening there in Washington, D.C.
Thank you, Gene. And for those, oh, there's a tangle here. Hang on a minute. Let me fix this. Much better. And for those who have never remodeled a kitchen, there is a term called backsplash. The backsplash, as we learned, are the tiles right behind the sink that keep the backsplash from doing bad things to your wall. So, Gene, you learned something today, presumably. Thank you, Gene and Bernice, for the opportunity to talk about what ACB and others are doing relative to providing accessible prescription drug labeling information. This is a personal issue for me. In 2005, my mother passed away at the age of 84. For the previous 10 years or so, she had Parkinson's. And if you've ever had a family member, a friend with Parkinson's, you know that it is not a fun thing. The numbers of different prescription medications you take can be in the double digits. I think my mother was on 10 to 12 different pills. In the last 3 to 5 years of her life, she developed age-related macular degeneration. She'd been living in Las Vegas since the 94 earthquake, and Donna and I, when we began dating, visited her a couple of times a year, beginning, I guess, in 2001. And my mom had a full-time caregiver, but some of the caregivers that were hired in Las Vegas needed caregiving themselves. And there were a couple of three occasions when Donna and I would show up, and my mother, who was an independent type to the end, always wanted to do things her way. And Donna, who, you know, is low vision herself, she spent a fair amount of time on our visits sorting out my mother's medication. So I've been aware of the situation for a number of years. Additionally, and I'm not going to mention his name because I didn't get permission, but some of you know who I'm talking about. Probably 4 or 5 years ago, a fairly well-known CCB member messed up his medication, took two of one pill and none of another, ended up falling in the shower because he became drowsy and cracked some ribs. Fortunately, he came through it okay, but if you've ever had cracked ribs, that's not something you really want to do. So this was a personal issue for me. And for a number of years, the American Council of the Blind was aware of the problem facing blind and visually impaired people in being able to read the information contained on prescription drug labels. We were aware of members who had inadvertently taken the wrong pill or an improper dose of medication. And as I said, this happened to a CCB member a few years back. To highlight the seriousness of the problem, medication misuse has caused more than 1 million adverse drug events per year in the United States. That's a lot. So knowing that the majority of individuals experiencing vision loss do so in their 60s and beyond, and that these individuals are also experiencing other limitations which can affect cognitive and physical functioning, ACB believed that it was long past time for all prescription drug information available to the sighted public to likewise be made available to those of us with little or no vision. Our efforts began in 2011 and resulted in the introduction of legislation which was ultimately incorporated into Senate Bill 3187, the Food and Drug Administration Safety and Innovation. It was passed by Congress and signed into law by President Obama on July 9th, becoming Public Law 112144. What was created by passage of that statute is the Working Group on Access to Prescription Drug Label Information. I just violated my own rule by not turning off my cell phone. I once did that at a meeting. I announced people should turn off their cell phones, and fate spit in my eye by having my phone ring right away. So, what was created then was the Work Group on Access to Prescription Drug Label Information under the auspices of the United States Access Board. The purpose of this work group, and I now quote from the legislation, is to develop best practices on access to information on prescription drug container labels for individuals who are blind or visually impaired. We are to do this within 1 year of enactment of the statute, meaning that by this upcoming July, about the time of our national conference and convention, a document, and again I quote from the statute, for pharmacies to ensure that blind and visually impaired individuals have safe, consistent, reliable, and independent access to the information on prescription drug container labels will be made available to the public. The statute also makes clear that such best practices are not to be considered accessibility guidelines or standards for the Access Board. And I'll get into what is going to happen down the road in a few minutes. The work group is comprised of representatives from the senior, disability, and blind and visually impaired communities, along with the major national pharmacy chains and industry lobbyists. Our members include ACB, and I serve on that. In fact, when the Access Board was looking to put the working group together, I called our governmental affairs person, Eric Bridges. I said, Eric, I know you're in Washington, D.C., and I'm in California, but would you object if I made it possible for you not to attend yet another Washington, D.C. meeting? And he thanked me profusely. So I'm the ACB rep. We have representation from the American Foundation for the Blind, Blinded Veterans Association, CCLVI, and our representative on from CCLVI, Council of Citizens of Low Vision International, is Annette Carter, who some of you also know is ACB's web administrator, and NFB. I'm pleased to say that without exception, those of us representing the blind and visually impaired community have spoken absolutely with one voice and in total unanimity on this issue. Before going any further, let me mention that at the outset, the Access Board asked all stakeholders to submit what we believe to be best practices. the things that pharmacies should do to provide access. Thanks primarily to the efforts of Linda Dardarian, most of us should in this room should know who Linda is, and a bunch of folks listening on ACB Radio as well. And with an introduction drafted by yours truly, hurriedly one morning, ACB submitted our document, which is on the ACB website, www.acb.org, as well as on the Access Board's website, which is www.usaccessboard.gov. That's kind of a cool website anyway. CCLVI also submitted a statement, which is available at their website, which is www.ccclvi.org/large-print-guidelines-html. In ACB's best practices document, we call for all information, and I stress all information on prescription medication labels, which a pharmacy attaches to containers. And when we say containers, we mean bottles, boxes, vials, tubes, etc., be made available in alternate formats, including Braille, large print, and audible formats. We further outline specific parameters for the use of each format, and to ensure completeness and consistency, we recommend prescription label information be presented in a specific order. Name of customer, name of medication, dosage instructions, expiration date, refill information, and prescription number, pharmacy name and phone number, prescribing doctor's name and phone number, warning label information, and reminder of patient to, quote, check information sheet for other important medication details. And we worked that out and that order in collaboration with Linda and with Lainey to be consistent with the structured negotiations efforts that they and ACB and CCB and Bay State Council of the Blind are involved with several of the pharmacy chains. Since the work group was constituted, we have met four times. The first time in January at the Access Board offices in Washington, D.C., and three times by teleconference, the most recent of these this past Tuesday. At least one additional meeting by phone is scheduled for later this month, and a draft document is supposed to be circulated to us during May prior to its release in July. I've already mentioned that those of us from the blind and visually impaired community have been speaking with one voice, making it clear to pharmacies that they must provide accessible prescription information in the customer's preferred format. The reason eyewitnesses are so unreliable, and ear witnesses for that matter, is that no matter what you hear, if they're is more than one person hearing it or seeing it, one of them, maybe both, screw it up. And we have heard off and on over the past couple of months from folks who are saying, you're favoring one format over the other. You don't want to include new technology. You're doing this, you're doing that. Well, it just ain't so. I can't make it any clearer than that to those who insist on misunderstanding either accidentally or on purpose. We've also pointed out, that since technological innovation never stops, the industry should not limit itself to current solutions such as ScriptTalk and the Talking RX bottle. In fact, at our face-to-face meeting in January, we were shown a smartphone app which reads a prescription label. The fellow who is marketing that must have been a hell of a used car salesman at one time, because he sent out emails all over the bloody world making sure people understand that there are other ways to read prescriptions. I won't mention his name here, but he knows who he is, and he could well be listening. Jerry, you're a nice guy anyway. It's interesting to note that one of the chains participating on the work group is Express Scripts, a national mail order chain which has offered Braille prescription labels to its blind customers for some time upon request. And at our meeting, our face-to-face in January, there were a number of vendors who were there, and we got a chance to see the Express Scripts Braille labels, which were pretty cool. We got to see, and I was hoping that they'd be exhibiting here this week, but they're not. A company called Accessimed up in Oregon, which has a Talking RX bottle similar to the one those of us who are Kaiser customers should know well, but its speech chip is longer. And actually, the bottle's even better. Not to mention the aforementioned smartphone app, and the ScriptTalk. So all the vendors were there. It was also interesting to note, and rather ironic, to hear comments at our first meeting from representatives of several of the national pharmacy chains, announcing with considerable pride what they were about to do for their blind and visually impaired customers, namely using the ScriptTalk. What those chains are doing is to offer that ScriptTalk device in a number of their stores throughout the country, and I'll put a plug for one of our structured negotiation settlements at the end of this. And a lot of those stores, in fact, are in California. The first, of course, to go public is Walmart. So why is this ironic, you ask? Well, because what they didn't mention is that the reason for this newfound commitment to serving blind and visually impaired customers, the fact that ACB and CCB has moved them to do so thanks to structured negotiations agreements we've entered into or will be entering into with these chain pharmacies. They wanted the folks there to think that they were doing it out of the goodness of their soft kumbaya hearts. In fact, when we went on break after, and I've forgotten which of the pharmacy reps went and made the point, I took our contingent aside, the AFB and NFB folks aside, and I said, you know, you realize that they're doing this because we made them, not because they're so interested in having us as their customers. You know, a little bit of truth in advertising ain't a bad thing. And so it was all I could do after hearing this announcement to keep a straight face or to blurt out the reason for their altruism. Now, this isn't to say that the pharmacy representatives don't have legitimate concerns which need to be addressed. They do. For example, the small independent pharmacies are concerned about providing prescription information in Braille, short of acquiring an embosser. And maybe not so much in the big cities, but in the smaller communities in California and around the country, there's still a lot of small independent pharmacies. At our call on Tuesday, the major pharmacy chain industry representative kept raising the issue of how even the national pharmacies could fulfill requests for Braille prescription drug label information in the same time frame as they do for their sighted customers. You know, right now we go into a pharmacy, let's say just visited the doctor, we've picked up some kind of bug or whatever, and we need our script now. So how are they going to do that? Well, we recognize it's an issue. We also recognize that with big pharma, cost shouldn't be a problem. While we acknowledged that these concerns are legitimate, we also pointed out that our responsibility is to stipulate what constitutes best practices, meaning these are the things we need and how such best practices are to be accomplished is kind of a separate issue. I do believe that the document which ultimately comes out of our work group's discussions will reflect that there are unique technical, financial, manpower, and other factors specific to smaller chains and independents. Let me do something that I probably should have done sooner. Let me define what is meant by prescription drug label, because it ain't as simple as you might think. It is a legal document that must be prepared by the pharmacist filling the prescription. The pharmacist must ensure the accuracy of the prescription medication label and include on the label all elements required by applicable state law. Believe it or not, federalism is such a wonderful thing. Every state can have a separate statute and set forth separate and distinct elements for prescription drug labels. You'd think something like that might, you know, be uniform across the board from state to state. It's not. My understanding is that the California requirements for what needs to appear on a prescription drug label are the most stringent, which is, I guess, for us a good thing. And that shouldn't surprise anyone in this room. At least as of the work group's most recent meeting, the best practices put forward in both ACB and CCLBI's documents have been included in toto. For Braille labels, and I'm not listing everything, particularly when it comes to the low vision stuff, because it's pretty lengthy and needs to be. For Braille labels, use contracted grade 2 Braille, print Braille label on tape with strong adhesive, place Braille label on top of standard print labels, do not fold Braille label. For large print labels, among other things, print prescription drug labels on non-glossy paper. When covering the label with protective tape, use non-glossy tape. Use print with highest possible contrast between text and background color. Print duplicate label in 18-point bold font attached to container. There is no way, and even we recognize this, and even the CCLVI rep understood this. 18-point type, if your average prescription bottle, you'd get about 3 lines. So we understand, and that's why we're talking about duplicate labels. And there are a number of other recommendations directly from CCLVI's large print standards document, which somebody by the name of Donna Pomerantz was instrumental in putting together. So what happens once the final document is released? The National Council on Disability will conduct an informational and educational campaign in cooperation with the stakeholder working group, that means us, to inform the public, including people with disabilities and pharmacists, of the best practices. The Government Accountability Office will then undertake a review beginning 18 months after the date of the release of the report to assess the extent to which pharmacies are following the best practices and to what extent barriers to information on prescription drug labels remain. So that effort will begin, if my math is proper, in January of 2015. So that's where matters currently stand. Obviously, folks, you have a responsibility. You have a job and a role in this as well. And the older I get, the more I push the issue of responsibilities beyond the fact that, yeah, we all have rights, but we also all have responsibilities as blind people, particularly those of us who are members of a consumer advocacy organization such as this. Your responsibility will be to go into your pharmacy, and even though you know that they probably aren't going to provide any of the things we talked about, unless you're going to a Walmart or one of the other pharmacies we're working with, your responsibility nonetheless is to ask for the format of your choice. In fact, if I were you, when the final document comes out, I'd get a copy, either download it from the Access Board website or contact the ACB office. And hopefully the CCB office will have copies as well, and bring it to your pharmacist and make sure it gets into the hands of the manager. That's your responsibility. And if you don't meet that responsibility, you're failing your blind brothers and sisters. Related to this, I was asked by Lainey Feingold to remind everyone that as a result of concluding our successful structured negotiation efforts with Walmart, ScriptTalk talking prescription containers are now available to its mail order customers throughout the country and at 33 of its stores, including a number of stores in California. And I think Donna, that's up on the CCB website. Oh, she left me. Okay.
I think it's also been on the connection.
You're listening to the stream. Well, that's I'm on the stream, by the way. Okay. So that should be up on the site, and you can get that. For details, interested parties can access, and this is Lainey's website, https://lflegal.com/2013/03/walmart-info-. Looks like two forward slash. It's easier to get it from one of our offices. You can also call Walmart to order at 1-888-227-3403. And that at long last is it. So I don't know, Gene, I haven't been paying attention to time. If you got time for some questions, assuming there are some. There you go. Right there.
We're limited time, but I'm going to take two questions from the audience in a second. But I'm going to ask you, yes, Bernice, during the deliberations, particularly the one in face to face, was there any discussion as to what it brought about, like in Europe, where they have Braille on the at least the item on the over-the-counter prescriptions as well as the prescription boxes. I've had people bring me boxes from over France, and they told me places with Braille. Of course, it's in French, but I was just wondering if they talked about that, and I'm certain those are companies that are also in this country, too.
Interestingly enough, no. That, to my recollection, has not been referenced. So we really, you know, we haven't talked about it at all, at least as far as I can recall, Gene.
And it's great Braille, too. Okay, Bernice, you got your mic there?
Yes. Well, first of all, two things. I wanted to also recognize Donna Sanchez and Diane Deutsch and myself, along with Donna, were four of the six people that developed the large print guidelines. And secondly, somebody, a vision teacher, came to my house to put Braille labels on some pill bottles for me some years ago. And they used green Dymo tape and put it over the print on the bottle so that even a sighted person couldn't tell me. So I hope I heard you say the word clear on that tape with adhesive backing.
If I didn't, we're talking non-glossy. And yeah.
Well, non-glossy and clear are two different things. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Unfortunately, because we're really behind, I take two questions from the audience. If somebody can help us identify who.
Thank you. Mitch, congratulations on this excellent work. I'm wondering in terms, this is Steve Mendelson, by the way, I'm wondering in terms of our responsibility, whether you feel that in assisting particularly the independent pharmacists to understand and comply with these aspirations, there's any role for technical assistance to be offered by state and local ACB affiliates and chapters.
Well, obviously that's to be desired, Steve, given the nature of the organization. You know, they have to take the bull by the horns. We'll provide them with whatever materials, the document and all of that. So absolutely. And Bernice, I wasn't clear. I wasn't sure who all was part of that low vision group. So thank you for putting in the additional names.
Californians, at least.
I just heard one end of numerous conversations that Donna was having. One more question.
The last question.
This is Gigi DeMarie from the Redwood Empire and from the San Francisco chapter. And I would like to hold a meeting and invite the independent pharmaceutical stores and the, like our CVS and Rite Aid. If we were to hold some time of a forum like that, would there be somebody available that would come to the chapter and give the presentation?
Well, I think what needs to happen first, because it's going to take some time to disseminate this information. So what you might want to do is to get copies of the document when it comes out in July. And you know, depending on the size of the community in which you live, you know, if you're talking Santa Rosa or Petaluma or whatever, as a chapter project, disseminate the document to your local pharmacies. You can certainly do that, but I think down the road, a forum of this kind would probably be very valuable. And you've got you've got two of us in California, although Annette Carter is a whole lot closer to Santa Rosa than am I, but that's certainly within the realm of possibility.
There you go, Gene.
Okay. That's unfortunately the end of the questions, but Donna Pomerantz wanted to provide one bit of information, and I'll let her speak.
So quickly, the Walmart that is active already is the one in Mountain View. So we have a word tells me that we have a large chapter there. So hopefully all of you will tell your friends and their friends, et cetera, to, you know, within that chapter, to go to Walmart and ask for the ScriptTalk prescriptions. Also, the other thing is, if your local Walmart is not using the ScriptTalk for this pilot, ask them. Call the Walmart, ask them, and, you know, we'll see about making that happen. Linda and Lainey need you to do that so that we can also show the need. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Donna. And I also want to thank Mitch very much for the excellent presentation. Let's give him a hand. Okay. Is Mr. Tapping here? Good morning. Could you please come to the head table to my right, please? You may recall that 5 years ago, we had a presentation during the general session from the beginning of the High-Speed Rail Authority and heard what their plans were, and a lot was theory, hope, but very constructive, positive attitudes. Well, as you've been following the news, this is no longer a theory. It's reality. Very shortly, construction will begin on the California high-speed rail, which I'm looking forward to when it's constructed to ride it, since I've ridden the bullet train in Japan, and that's incredible. And this is going to be different technology, but at least it's going to be giving us another option how to get from Northern to Southern California. We're very fortunate this morning to have Mr. John Tapping, who is the risk manager for the California High-Speed Authority, and he's going to give us an update and talking about how they're easing access in while ensuring that safety for passengers and workers is maintained. So let's give Mr. Tapping a hand.
Good morning. Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here. I want to thank the California Council of the Blind for this gracious opportunity. Can everybody hear me okay out there?
A little louder.
Okay. A little closer. Better?
There you go.
Okay. Much gratitude. Thanks. I'm honored to be here. I'm going to basically summarize the status of where we are on the high-speed rail program. I'm going to talk about some safety and security policies and procedures that we're implementing into the design of the train. And I'm also going to talk about accessibility. My background is I am a civil structural engineer with approximately 30 years in the transportation industry. I worked for the California Department of Transportation for many of those years on some of our very large mega projects, the Bay Bridge for one. And I was actually the risk manager on that very significant mega project before I came on to the high-speed rail about 6 months ago. I am very, very excited about this project. My passion is mega projects, transportation projects, and having been in the highway industry for so long, it's really, really refreshing to come and to build a train. And what is so cool, actually, about this job for me is it's really the ground floor. I mean, the program has been around for a while, but it's really building momentum. We have a funding to begin our segments through the Central Valley, and so it's very, very exciting time of the project. And the other thing that I wanted to say is basically, you know, the station design is very preliminary at this stage. So the authority would welcome any comments from the CCA with respect to accessibility and other matters that are important to it. And we would consider those. So there's definitely an open forum in regards to that. You can contact me directly. We have architects that are working on these type of issues as I speak. So, a summary. Well, it's going to be the largest public infrastructure project in U.S. history, currently estimated at $68 billion. And it's basically going to provide a high-speed rail system, 200 miles an hour plus, through the Central Valley. And actually, there's various stages of it, which I'll talk about in more detail. It'll be a sealed corridor, completely grade-separated, fenced, and for access control. Steel wheel-on-wheel and double-tracked. And the first phase of 520 miles and 800 miles when the system is fully realized. So it's very exciting. Like any other huge mega project, you have to build it in incremental stages. And we have a strategy outlined in our business plan to do that in a cost-effective and efficient way. Why is California ideally suited for high-speed rail? Well, freeway congestion, for one thing. You know, as a result of my earlier work on all the freeways and bridges, you know, I've firsthand dealt with that. And California has some of the most congested highways in the nation. Also, economic productivity. California has the highest productive metropolitan regions, leading to a well-established intercity travel market. And there are mega regions. Caltrans high-speed rail system will connect two key mega regions, the San Francisco Bay Area and the Los Angeles Basin via the Central Valley. And high-speed rail provides a service competitive with all air travels in one of the nation's busiest short-haul markets. Also, California's population and size growth. California has some of the largest and fastest growing regions in the nation. Transit connections. California has numerous city centers where existing transit networks provide connectivity. And existing intercity rail market. California has well patronized intercity rail services. So all of these factors together, I think, really bode well for this method of transportation through California. And high-speed rail is not just high-speed rail. It's actually our revised business plan was one that emphasized interconnectivity and consistency among all the transportation, both rail and other in the California. A big part of our revised business plan was early investments. In other words, a blended system and working with Caltrain to modify its system and enhance its system to be compatible with high-speed rail. Our initial operating section will be Merced to San Fernando Valley, and that was another revision we made to our business plan, was basically to open up a segment that ran all the way from Merced to through Fresno, Bakersfield, and through the Tehachapi Mountains, which will be a very exciting engineering accomplishment, to Palmdale. And so basically open up the valley for that travel. And by doing that, basically our business model is to inspire financial private investment into the system. And we're currently actually getting a lot of contact from private rail operators, maintenance entities that are very interested in participating. So as we move forward, we will probably go more into a public-private partnership type of system. The Beta Basin, after the initial operating segment, is San Jose to the San Fernando Valley, and that will be followed by the Phase 1 blended, which is a San Francisco to L.A. Union Station and Anaheim, that's 520 miles. And then Phase 3 will extend it both to the north and the south to Sacramento and San Diego, approximately 800 miles. So some of the benefits of mega project construction, we're anticipating that 20,000 jobs will be created annually for 5 years. Phase one blended, we're anticipating approximately 66,000 jobs annually for 15 years. So it brings with it some real economic vitality to the Central Valley as well as other areas of the state. But primarily, a lot of our emphasis is in business development in the Central Valley, and hiring, and we have very specific small business goals as well in our contracts. So with respect to funding, it's a multitude of funding sources. We have state, federal, private, and local resources. $6 billion has been approved so far by the legislature for the first construction segment. $3.3 billion of that comes from federal, and a $2.7 from the Prop 1A, which was approved by the California voters. Typically, our philosophy is to identify funding for the construction segment before we begin construction, and also that the construction segment has some utility associated with it, with the funding. Again, I'd like to emphasize that the ridership and revenue studies that we have exhaustively performed and validated by the GAO as reasonable. Again, we see that private industry is very interested in coming and looking at their business model for getting involved as we go further. So, update on procurement process. It's a very exciting time for the project. Our first project is 26 miles from Merced, Fresno, and it's basically constructing the rail bed and the bridges that will support the train. It's not the train system yet, or the rail associated with it, but basically the foundation for which it will sit. And that project is approximately $1.5 billion, and we're poised actually to award that project. It's going through an evaluation process at this point. The contractor is awarded based on a qualifications-based and a price-based approach. And so very shortly, I think you will be hearing the results of that procurement, and we're very excited about breaking ground this summer. So we're jumping into this project. We have the funding to do so, and it's very exciting for me at this point. Very shortly thereafter, we will also put out solicitations for the design and build from Fresno to Bakersfield. We're currently going through the environmental impact process for that section, but also anticipate putting out a request for qualifications for design builders in the very near future. So as you might expect, over the last year or so, it's an interesting business model at High Speed Rail. It's very quite lean in terms of government employees. When I came on, there were about 40, and that was 6 months ago. Now I think we have about 60, and ultimately I think we still plan to play to be very lean. We have key management positions, and our mantra is that government people should make appropriate government decisions. We are supported by a lot of consultant and private consulting services, which we manage. And we basically set the direction and the strategic goals and manage the consultants as we deliver these projects. Coming from a very, very large organization, I'm very impressed with the High Speed Rails organization because of it is streamlined. Being a risk manager, one of my greatest challenges in earlier jobs was you tend to have functional, what I will call a good name for it is excellence. Others will call it silos, where the communication is sometimes not the best. And here we're very lean. We have key management positions. If there's a cross-functional issue, for example, a design, a construction, a safety issue, I can go directly to the next office and have that discussion and get to a resolution fairly quickly. So we can make streamlined decisions. We have lots of checks and balances, but at least our management structure, I think, is rather lean and mean, and we've been hiring some really good people and building momentum. So what about the schedule? Well, I mentioned we want to start breaking ground this summer. And that's for our initial operating segment, which will be from Merced through to Palmdale. And that whole process until opening is scheduled to take about 7 to 8 years. So it's a very long project. That's the length of it is a significant. They're significant projects, plus all integration of the systems, certification of the train. There's many things that have to lead into that schedule. And then after that, the Beta Basin construction from 2021 to 26. And starting right away, though, I talked about the early investment and the blended systems approach of the new business plan, which is really, I think, more of a partnering approach with all the local agencies, with the city of Fresno, Bakersfield. We've done extensive outreach in the last year to involve all the stakeholders in the environmental impact approaches. And that's been one of our main philosophies in going forward. So it's a long project. I surely hope to be around to ride the first train. That's my goal. So I wanted to shift a little bit to safety, security, and access. Recognizing I'm not the expert on accessibility issues, I have consulted some of our expert staff, and will report some of their key initiatives that they're moving forward with. But I want to say that what is refreshing is we're wide open to ideas, and you can contact me directly with those, and we will open consider them. So, safety and security are prime considerations in the design of the system. What we are using is a risk-based approach, where basically we identify a probability and an impact. It's kind of an innovative approach, where you can get rather sophisticated and say, you know, what is the probability of an event happening, and if it happens, what's the impact of it happening? And through that, you develop some priorities of where you focus. But the main strategy there is to design safety and security into the system. And that's rather complex because you have design, you have construction, you have operations, you have maintenance, and it all one affects the other. And you really have to know what's at the downstream end in terms of, you know, access and egress and security to want to design it in. So it's important to upfront do a risk-based safety and security assessment of the system and get all functional areas involved in that, engineering, operations, and come up with some recommendations to actually put in the design packages that we're putting out now. So we have some interesting issues. For example, one example is in the alignment from Fresno to Bakersfield, there's some alternate alignments under consideration. And one of them go through actually, if you can believe it, an oil field with a lot of wells, and so we've had to do a very sophisticated analysis there. You know, if we have to move those, do you abandon them? And if you abandon them, what's the probability that something untoward could happen? And so all of these kind of decisions roll into the alignment, the ultimate alignment that's chosen. And that's true with other safety and security issues, because it's much cheaper. You don't want to come in after you're running trains and say, why didn't we think of that? Mm-hmm. You know, we need a wall here and to protect us from maybe a cul-de-sac that's a local cul-de-sac or something like that. So we do these site assessments during the design reviews. That our mantra is prevention through design, and that's a key principle. We are mindful in the process of doing this of all the needs of the disabled, and we do recognize that some of them are competing values, and so we're open to all of those suggestions. As far as our construction programs are concerned, they are fully compliant with Cal OSHA regulatory requirements for worker safety. Also, there are local requirements for traffic safety and community notification, and the Federal Railroad Administration requirements along work of the right-of-way. So there are some very prescriptive safety requirements that are built into not only the authorities' safety procedures and policies, but also when we hire a design builder, they are bound by these requirements also. and we have checks and balances over our design builder to ensure that they comply with these safety requirements through oversight by an agent of the authority separate from the design builder, and also by authority staff. So we take construction safety very seriously and have the checks and balances in place to ensure it. Also, safety and security during operations are fully compliant with FRA requirements. That's the Federal Railroad Administration, and for operation of high-speed trains. And it's based on best practices of U.S. passenger railroads and international high-speed rail operations and experiences. We are also doing extensive coordination now with the Office of the State Fire Marshal, as well as the local emergency response organizations throughout the Central Valley. And so we've engaged those in a partnering relationship and are also implementing their suggestions into our prevention through design. Security on the system will focus on both criminal and terrorist activities, and we're still developing our policing strategy, but most likely it'll be a combination of local policing with a matrix to some statewide uniformity leadership, and we're still looking at that. But as far as the security, it'll be based on international practices as applied to high rail operations. And recently there was a Mineta study which outlined some of the best practices in safety and security, and most of it is focused and will be focused at the stations. And again, we're in the early development of the station design, so we're open to a lot of impact, and I think there's going to be a lot of key decision points as we move forward in those designs. The design of the system with respect to accessibility issues, again, is in full compliance with ADA and Title 24 of the Building Code and the State of California DGS DSA California Assess Compliance Reference Manual. And also the Office of State Architect has authority having jurisdiction. So there's a lot of regulation here, but from what my accessibility experts are telling me, there's a lot of work to be done here because there's a lot of inconsistencies in local, federal, and state desires with regard to various disabled groups and accessibility. So I think one of the suggestions internally was we need to really to start partnering with all of these entities and establish some uniformity as we move forward. I mentioned station design, and again, very exciting. I think the first contract for the stations will be in about 3 to 4 years, so we have plenty of time to work with your organization and are willing to do so. Blind architecture has actually been engaged in the development of preliminary design principles, and I surely would have liked to have that individual here today, but he's busy cranking out designs, so I'm busy trying to manage a risk, but yes, it is. So the accessibility principles for the stations generally are as follows. Accessible to and usable by individuals with disabilities. Challenge is to accommodate the needs of the varied, somewhat competing disabilities, as I discussed, blind, hearing impaired, wheelchair bound, partially disabled, and temporary disabled persons. Focusing on the public entrances that will be accessible. Elevators, escalators, and stairs provide access between levels. Accessible paths will connect site access point with station entrances into the trains. And also a wayward finding system, which I think is very in the very early stages of development, is something we're looking at. And we understand that there's a lot of innovation that's coming that way. Even in the last 2 years, things have changed rapidly. So we're doing due diligence on looking at that research internationally and going forward and looking at a wayward system that will be effective and efficient. Specific provisions for blind and sight impaired stations are being considered for the high-speed rail stations. As I mentioned, ADA, it doesn't provide much guidance here. We are looking potentially at detective warnings, at changes of direction, and hazardous areas will be specified for safety. One thing in Europe that's been done considerably is directional tactile routes, but again, we're finding that there's some inconsistency there among European countries, and so again, that would require coordination with our local partners to ensure that connectivity is consistent with respect to any tactile routes. Yeah, caution, as I understand it, directional tactiles can cause unintended consequences for other disabled or non-disabled passengers. So again, we will have to work with all the parties and stakeholders as we move forward in that regard. Let's see. I'm almost there. We're looking at tactile tiles at platform edges with contrasting colors for partially blind and tactile bumps for cane users. Adequate head clearances will be provided throughout for safety. Braille at elevators outside and inside. However, the comment, editorial comment, Braille as a wayward finding tool is generally ineffective. And we're looking at audible signals at key locations. So there are several emerging wayward technologies for the visually impaired that are very exciting. GPS applications, again, they're changing, advancing, you know, as we speak. And although I'm told that we're not there yet with applying these, that is one thing we're looking at since we have some time in developing these station designs. Talking signs and smartphone applications also. I'm told about a speak and move technology. But again, there's development to be done there. We're talking about potentially the physical raised map type of system also. And let's see, some architectural design technologies we're looking at are acoustic feedback, sound makers, changing floor materials, and distinctive acoustics at ticket gates. So again, these are some of the things when I talked about with our architects who are looking at this, and I'm very passionate about it, are considering as we move forward. And again, I'd like to say that it's a blank slate, and we would welcome any suggestions from the CCB. And so that's my presentation. And I'm happy to be here to answer any questions.
I'm going to speak first, and then we'll recognize it. But go ahead, work your way to Frank. Mr. Tapping, we will take you up on the invitation to provide input. I'm the chair of the Committee on Access and Transportation. This is something I've been working on for decades, and probably one of the entities, in addition to the consumer groups you should work with, is the Division of State Architects Disability Advisory Committee, which I sit on, and it has across disabilities and architects and a variety of different people that have interests in seeing that access is provided. A lot of the things you mentioned are really important, but one of the I'd say is sometimes low tech, as you were talking about the tactile pathways, sometimes can be more effective, and that's where balancing out, just like having stair stripings for the low vision, rather than having just the markings on the upper and lower tread. If it's interior station, have it on all the treads, and we found the yellow-orange works the best for the low vision most people. So there's a lot of things there, and we'll definitely be in contact with you and like to work with you. Okay, Frank.
Yeah, to follow up on that question, perhaps you can tell us specifically how and who we should be contacting now to have that dialogue, because we can tell you from experience two things. First off, if you do not directly include the input of our community and CCV in your designs now rather than waiting till pouring concrete. You will get it wrong. We can also assure you that if you get it wrong, and we've done this many times successfully, we will come after you in the courts.
What? That's not quite true. We have, as last resort, sometimes legal thing, but we really belong to this organization, sitting down with people and talking and working through things. And Frank is one of our knowledgeable people about things, and he'd be a great resource too. Yeah. Would you like to say?
Yeah. Thanks. I think I found a co-chair for the. Since CEO Jeff Morales came on, his mantra has been to engage all of our stakeholders passionately. It's not a secret that we have some lawsuits pending. Although, over the last 2 months, we've been successful in coming to resolution on three of those lawsuits, and I believe a fourth one is close. I'd like to emphasize is first of all the contact. You can contact me directly. I can give you my number. It's 916-397-4980. And what I will do is I also have a lead architect called, he told me I could give his name, who is very much familiar with this stuff, and he will probably be my lead technical person in helping me. And his name is Gary Newgard with Parsons Brinkerhoff, and his number is 415-243-4760. So if they're very technical questions and you'd just like to chat with him, he's open to do that. I will be the authority's one-stop shop with respect to this council, if it wishes. And
be your contact person.
Very good, and I'd be happy to work with you. Yeah.
Take another two questions. Charlene Brooks.
There he is. Charlene Ornelas from San Diego. I have two things. One is that you mentioned the point of entrance to the station, but it actually starts from the street. I understand the point of entrance is your jurisdiction, but if I have troubles getting there from the street, then I'm hindered at using the facility. And I know in working with others that has been a real issue. The other one I have is there is becoming a lot of information being put out on reader boards telling when the next bus, train, whatever will come, or if there's any detours or any information. There's been some debate as to whether that is information that needs to be provided to people that are blind and visually impaired, don't have print access. And I say that it is. I have the same right to know when the next bus or train will come as the sighted person next to me.
Thank you for that. I guess I was well briefed because I was told what the questions may be. And interconnectivity, I think, with the local transportation is a big thing. So we need to do some coordination as we move forward to make sure that, it's not just our facility, but it's how you get to our facility. So thank you. Yeah.
Hello, my question.
My name is David Jackson. And
you got the mic, David?
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
There you go. Okay. So my concern is platform and sitting on platforms. And you mentioned you mentioned two types of tile in your report.
Yes.
And so my concern is safety and on the platform. Safety from the platform to the vehicle itself. So I'm hoping that you will use a standard contrast, and you'll use a standard material for the truncated domes.
Okay. Okay.
David, it's in the code in California. It is. They have to use that yellow-orange color. It is in the building code for the detectable warnings. Just, yeah.
Thanks. I took notes. I'll take them back, and also I look forward to some communication, and maybe we could start a some type of peer panel. Yeah.
Thank you very much. And let's. We're very fortunate. Mr. Tapping was available and to come in and.
Business card.
Yeah. Do you have two business cards?
I do.
And let's give him a hand. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our next presentation is a little different, but it's some of you were, I know Dan Kaiser, but some others were involved in, it was the passage of, was it AB 1608? And which brought about the establishment of the California Commission on Disability Access. And great. And we thought it would be really good to learn about the past, present, and the future of the commission. And we have invited the executive director, who is I think only been with the commission for a few months, and let's give Stephen Castellanos a hand.
Thank you, Gene, and good morning, everybody. Can you hear me? Is that fine? Is the mic close enough?
A little closer.
A little closer?
Mm-hmm.
Again, I'd like to thank the council and for the opportunity to speak today and bring everyone up to date about what's happening at the commission. Please be kind to me because I started in mid-January and I'm just catching up. It's like drinking from a fire hose. That's a huge responsibility and the commission has, and certainly there are a lot of stakeholders, and this is a topic of tremendous interest throughout the nation. I mean, there are critical issues we're attempting to face and trying to forge a new path to increasing access for all in California. Gene said the California Commission on Disability Access was created by Senate Bill 1608 in 2008. The legislature's goal in creating the commission and the specific charges or the functions and duties that the legislature gave to the commission incorporated the results of several decades, in fact, of policy debates and legislation focused on how best to provide the optimum level of accessibility and usability of all facets of society by persons with disabilities. The words used by the legislature in Senate Bill 1608 relative to what the commission should in fact be trying to accomplish are unfortunately somewhat misleading, I believe at least, and I think that's shared by my many. And I think that's due largely to the focus of Senate Bill 1608 on the epidemic of accessibility lawsuits that continue to fester, and that they imply an unduly narrow role for the commission focused on public buildings or accommodations and getting businesses to comply with their legal obligations to serve the needs of the disabled community. But more specifically, although efforts were made to ensure that Senate Bill 1608 encompassed a number of issues important to the enhancement of accessibility in California, and those issues did part of the to-do list for the commission, the primary area for crafting and enacting Senate Bill 1608 was the need to address the large number of lawsuits, many of which were considered drive-by cases filed by self-serving attorneys and plaintiffs that involved mainly alleged building standard related violations. The commission in discussions has come to a little different conclusion, though, about a more overarching scope of the challenges facing the commission and what it can and should accomplish. And in the context of that Its endeavors to date should be measured and can be derived from an understanding that the genesis and the evolution of the commission relies on a long history. The starting point of any meaningful effort affecting accessibility in a positive manner is acknowledging and addressing the erroneous attitudes and stereotypes that most non-disabled individuals, including business owners and operators and government officials, have about the disabled community. And the first of those is that the, you know, quote, disabled individuals do not want to and cannot do most of the things that non-disabled individuals want to do and can do. The fact of the matter is that, in general, people with disabilities want to do everything non-disabled people want to and can do. They can do most things, and everyone involved, including business owners and operators, government entities, and officials at all levels, and most important for the purposes of the commission, must make this the commission must make this their guiding mantra and has made it their guiding mantra. When the commission analyzes their operations and actions to assess the extent to which they make things accessible to and usable by individuals with disabilities, that has to remain at the core of the mission's duties and responsibilities. Another prevailing stereotype is that all disabled individuals have the same conditions, that they have impaired sight or impaired hearing and or impaired mobility, and therefore, quote, I as a businessman or government official only need to think about and deal with those kinds of disabilities. In fact, the range of physical and mental disabilities that we all need to acknowledge and address, and we all know this is far broader. The last of these stereotypes that I'm listing here is that many business owners and operators are fearful of the accessibility topic in general, partly because of stereotypes such as those that I've just described, but also because of the fact that many of the laws intended to enhance accessibility are confusing, often contradictory and exceedingly ambiguous, and driven by specific fact or situation. For example, the multivariable moving target in the 8A known as readily achievable barrier removal. All in all, a great many businesses feel absolutely overwhelmed by trying to address accessibility and often simply avoid the issue whenever they can. In large part, Senate Bill 1608 was intended to address this pervading accessibility is a fearful thing sort of attitude. Since I've been involved with this issue, one of the things I'll say is that between 2000 and 2005, I served as the California State Architect and met Gene then, and when we were working on improving California's building codes. And a number of these stereotypes and notions about the disabled community and the difficulty of providing access, I learned about then. More interestingly, maybe, is that, my career as an architect, and I am an architect, started when I first, around 1975, and one of my first activities as an architect was to engage in the review of assessment problems at a new community college campus in Stockton, California, and we ended up filing a lawsuit against the college campus. Now I'm a trustee of that college. So it kind of everything sort of goes around and comes around, but it's what's interesting is taking a look at this from a longitudinal perspective. There's certainly been a great deal of progress in terms of legislation, regulation on the federal and state basis, but there continues to be this pervasive set of stereotypes and so-called difficulty in achieving compliance, and particularly with small business. So in continuing, it's critically important, I think, when assessing the role of the commission to recognize that notwithstanding the focus of Senate Bill 1608 and dealing with various aspects of accessibility litigation, the universe of accessibility is not limited to making business accessible to people with disabilities. In addition to primary issues addressed in 1608, a comprehensive view of enhancing accessibility needs to focus on a great many other important areas, you know, sort of where the rubber meets the road in terms of assisting persons with disabilities to lead the fullest lives possible. And this is a long list. I mean, it includes the notion of accessibility related to employment, housing, other than hotels and similar establishments, transportation, like we were just talking about, the discrimination in government-sponsored programs and activities in public places, discrimination in insurance coverage, discrimination in licensing and licensed services, access to telecommunications, which is an incredibly important area and increasingly so, accessibility and aspects of education, issues involving parental rights, custody and adoption, in-home supportive services, community mental health services, non-discrimination involving benefits such as income benefits, tax, business benefits, health care benefits, and Medi-Cal, right to medical treatment, civil rights of persons with mental and developmental disabilities. So as you can see, even though Senate Bill 1608 was primarily about litigation, the commission has not taken it on as simply the bricks and mortar issue. We're expanding and within our resources attempting to take a complete view of what this accessibility world is all about. This notion of, in a perfect world, the commission would not only deal with accessibility-related building standards and policies and procedures for businesses, but all these topics. There are, as I said, a significant number of federal, California, local statutes, regulations that pertain to providing and enhancing accessibility, although the commission logically should address as many of those laws as possible and fulfill its legislative obligations. Limited resources force the commission to devote its attention to the laws and regulations that have the greatest application to the ability of persons with disabilities to gain access to and use the greatest number of facilities and services and programs. I mentioned the notion of resources. We're currently funded, we're an 11-person commission, currently funded at about $400,000 a year with three staff. We're working hard to increase those resources because we think we have a unique opportunity with the commission, but there'll be more to come on that. So at the risk of oversimplifying, I think it can be safely said that accessibility-related policymaking must address limiting stereotypes and attitudes, as we've talked about, and then also deal with the two primary components of an environment that is accessible to and usable by persons with disabilities. And the first of those is the physical built setting, which deals with such bricks and mortar issues as accessibility-related building standards. For example, the 2010 ADA standards for accessible design and the California Building Code. The second is the people aspect of accessibility, which relates to such non-building standard issues as policies and procedures, for example, dealing with service animals, where disabled guests can sit in restaurants, making a business or government website usable by people with disabilities, ensuring that disabled guests can make guaranteed reservations for accessible rooms at hotels, making sure that all programs and activities are accessible to individuals with disabilities. So I mentioned the history before that resulted in the first bill, 1608. And while Senate Bill 1608 was not intended to deal exclusively with the accessibility of buildings and facilities, the impetus for that legislation grew out of a need to place reasonable parameters around the litigation and dispute resolution processes involving that particular aspect of the accessibility equation. And in that connection, the first meaningful statutes that set the stage for the development of the building standards for accessibility and ultimately the enactment of Senate Bill 1608 and creation of the commission were the Government Code Section 4450, which many of us know very much about, which were first added to California law in 1968. And in brief, this statute required accessibility in buildings and facilities constructed with government funding. Also in 1968, in the Health and Safety Code, what was added to California law was access to public accommodations by physically handicapped persons for buildings and facilities constructed with private funding. So when Government Code Sections 4450 and Health and Safety Code, et cetera, were enacted, the Uniform Building Code, which was then the model code on which California's building codes was based, contained very few limited accessibility standards. The two statutes that I just mentioned created the first real legislative imperative for the state, California, and particularly, as Gene mentioned, the state architect, to develop comprehensive building standards for publicly and privately funded buildings and facilities. Following the enactment of these statutes, the state architect started that process, which lasted throughout most of the 70s, included a great many individuals and interest groups, and not surprisingly involved a large number of very complex and contentious issues. All this work culminated in the adoption of a comprehensive set of accessibility-related construction standards, and those standards, in fact, became effective for the first time on July 1st of 1981, and did form, many believe, the basis for the Americans with Disabilities Act Accessibility Guidelines, or known as ADAG, which went into effect in 1992. Then, as has been the case ever since, the disabled community, which involves a wide spectrum of disparate interest, did considerable battle, as we all know, with the business community and frequently with state government generally, and my old office, the Division of the State Architect, in particular. Following the adoption of California standards, there were an increasing number of lawsuits filed for violation of the standards themselves, as well as for violations of several of the statutes mentioned that I've just mentioned. The volume of these lawsuits increased exponentially following the enactment of the ADA and the adoption of ADAG. So concurrently, it became obvious that there were a lot of problems with California's accessibility standards and building code. For example, a great many provisions were unclear or ambiguous. There were internal conflicts in the provisions, and a number of the issues that the standards did not cover needed to be addressed. The various parties involved in this issue, the disparate disabled community, the state's business interest, state government, for example, the state architect themselves, state fire marshal, Department of Housing, Department of Justice, the plaintiff's trial bar, others, continued their long-running warfare, and the end result was that we more or less got to gridlock. No one segment was able to really move the needle appreciably in addressing the types of problems described above, and as a result, there was a great deal of frustration on the part of individuals with disabilities due to the fact that they could not achieve meaningful, consistent enforcement of the statutes and building standards designed to enhance accessibility. And most people felt that notwithstanding the enactment of clear legislative mandates and the adoption of comprehensive building standards, the cause of accessibility, improved accessibility, had not been moved forward to any significant extent. Occasionally, the various interest groups all became equally frustrated with this state of affairs and agreed to work collaboratively to address a number of the problems. And for example, in the mid-90s, a number of advocates of the disabled community established a formal working group. I think Gene, you were involved with that.
Yep.
With several business interest groups and government officials, and the agreed operating premise was that each constituency would, and you probably remember this too, Gene, would leave their guns at the door, and that the group would identify those accessibility issues on which most, if not all, of the participants agreed and could and should be resolved. This led to a number of amendments to the building code that resulted in greatly heightened accessibility. And of particular importance to the role of the commission itself, one of the first things that this working group agreed upon was the need for there to be some sort of official person or entity to serve as an accessibility ombudsman to address all accessibility-related issues, problems, and policy considerations. Everyone in the disabled community, the business community, government agencies, and others needed some place to go to raise and resolve problems, to brainstorm ways to increase accessibility, and to slowly improve what many viewed as an incomplete and inadequate, some felt dysfunctional, accessibility environment. Some of the people who helped draft Senate Bill 1608 also had worked with on the working group, and this is really what led to the inclusion in that bill of the provisions to create the commission itself to serve as such an accessibility ombudsman. Although there existed a number of important problems and limitations pertaining to California's law and building standards, one of the most critical issues was that the fact that accessibility standards in the code and the ADAG are so confusing that design and construction professionals oftentimes, and certainly building officials frequently, did not understand exactly what had to be done to ensure compliant construction. As we know, this resulted in a great many new buildings being constructed and a great many existing buildings being improved, finding themselves in violation of the code and federal standards. And in such cases, the building owner typically bore all the legal and financial brunt of the mistakes made by the design professionals and the building department personnel. This caused a great number of building owners, including those who wanted to create greater accessibility and to avoid litigation when possible. And oftentimes they avoided construction whenever possible as well. And among other things, all this stymied efforts to improve the accessibility of California's existing building stock. So there was a goal to make sure that there were far fewer non-compliant construction and renovation projects as a result of all this. And with the specific reference to the commission, the legislature obviously intended to have it assist in achieving litigation and construction-related problems, and we were designed to address those issues. To these ends, the specific tasks delegated by the legislature to the commission included demand to study and make reports to the legislature on issues regarding compliance with state laws and regulations relative to disability access, including recommendations that would promote compliance with state laws and regulations relative to disability access, and whether public and private inspection programs, training and continuing education requirements are meeting the needs of both business and the disability communities. The second was asked the commission to act as an information center on the status of compliance in California with state laws and regulations providing persons with disabilities full and equal access to public facilities. Another charge was to coordinate with other state agencies and local building departments to ensure that information provided to the public on disability access requirements is uniform and complete. Another is to recommend, develop, prepare, or coordinate materials, projects, or other activities as appropriate relating to any subject within our jurisdiction. Another is to provide within our resources technical information and educational outreach. Also to recommend programs to enable persons with disabilities to obtain full and equal access to public facilities. We've been asked to advise the legislature on its activities, findings, and recommendations. And generally, the catch-all is to perform other functions and duties as authorized by statute or resolution. In other words, the commission's role is to address all of the various bricks and mortar and people aspects of the accessibility equation. This certainly includes not only dealing with construction and litigation considerations, but also the very broad spectrum of other accessibility-related challenges and opportunities. For example, one former member of the commission spent considerable time addressing the fact that very few California governmental entities had an accessibility coordinator as required by law and had any idea of where to go to find out exactly what they could, should do to make their programs and services accessible to people with disabilities. To this day, most in state government defaulted on this notion that the Department of Rehabilitation, because it would provide these services, because it was assumed that they would be able to take care of all these considerations. And I think what we've all learned in the process is that this, in fact, was or is not part of the Department of Rehabilitation's responsibility, and the department has no comprehensive way currently to address this issue, even if it were ordered to do so. To make this problem concrete, how does, for example, a disabled individual fill out government employment applications or pay his or her taxes online when the systems and procedures needed to enable accessibility and usability of those functions don't exist? So the challenges faced by government, business, and persons with disabilities certainly are complex. The commission represents an opportunity to change strategy, adopt new methods, and create essential partnerships toward this difficult goal of creating an accessible California for all of us. So that lays out a bit of a history for how we got here. There's been a subsequent bill, Senate Bill 1186, that's modified some of the reporting responsibilities of the commission, but the core duties and responsibilities of the commission remain intact. As I mentioned, commission consists of 11 appointed individuals appointed by the governor, by the Senate, and the Assembly. We're at an all-time low right now with regard to the appointments. We have four public appointees. We're required to have six public members that represent the disabled community and five that represent the business community. We're down to one business community representative and three disabled community representatives. We have been working with the governor's office and others to fill out the commission so we can actually accomplish our work. But in the meantime, we are, since I've arrived a couple of months ago, working very hard to essentially pick up the pace. The commission, when it was first formed, did establish a number of committees. There were certainly growing pains in the early days. There were budgeting issues and the delay in receiving initial funding. Certainly part of that was due to the state's economic climate. For example, in 2010, I think the budget, as we all recall, was late by several months, and that was right in the midst of the commission receiving its initial funding. So there were certainly external reasons for the commission slowing down, but I think it's taken a while for the commission itself to begin to grapple with what its true mission is. And I believe the mission is clear in the legislation, and that's what we're returning to now in terms of meeting the not only the demands of the of legislation, but attempting to take this unique opportunity of creating a positive dialogue between the business community, government, and the disabled community, and turn it into this dialogue, this new community, this inclusive community, into an opportunity to seek greater access while hopefully avoiding litigation. We are collecting claims and demand letters right now, and we'll be putting them on our website in mid-July for all to see. We haven't seen much of a reduction yet in claims and litigation and demand letters. But you know, we'll see what happens over time. We'll be doing this until 2016. I think the result of that data collection will be revealing in terms of what we find. We'll be reporting out. The legislature has asked for the top 10 violations. I think we're going to see a lot more than that that we'll be listing online. One of the things I think we have to remember in terms of changing language, though, and I talked about stereotypes and misconceptions before, and this notion of drive-by lawsuits. Many believe this is an industry that was formed, and certainly people are making money, but they're making money because of opportunity that's there. There is failure. There has been the modernizations, remodeling has occurred at a very slow pace. The addition of the access specialist in California, the certified access specialist, was intended to begin to provide more support for that. That's happening at a slower pace than I think we all intended. What we learned from the data collection, what we try to do with the state architect in increasing public access and local government access to CAS professionals is going to be critical over the next few years, and we are working with those agencies. The legislature has asked us to partner with the Department of Rehabilitation and the state architect particularly, and more, but particularly those two agencies, and we have established very strong relationships at the director level to make sure that those things happen. We have a very good relationship. I have a very good relationship with Tony Sauer, the director of the Department of Rehabilitation, and with Chet Whittem, the state architect, as well. We're beginning to move the needle, as they say, on providing tools and resources. The other thing we're doing is reaching out to local government and learning what they're doing. We're finding that in many cases, some of the initiatives, some of the efforts and support that's provided at the local government level are tremendous resources in and of themselves, and trying to find opportunities through our website, whatever other method that we can determine to share those best practices is another project we have underway. So I've probably taken more than my time, and I'll just open it up to questions.
We can take two questions. Okay, Mitch, you get the first one.
Thank you, Gene. Mr. Castellanos, first of all, let me wish you all the luck in the world. I am a former commissioner.
I know.
And for those who don't know, I spent two of the most frustrating chase my tail years of my life as a member of the commission to show you how seriously the governor takes the commission. When my term expired, they failed to submit the paperwork on time, or perhaps the former executive director failed to submit the paperwork on time. And by the time the governor's office contacted me about being reappointed, I said, thank you, but no thank you. You didn't mention that one of our charges was within a year to have to develop a comprehensive document outlining for primarily local government entities the standards, both the state standards under the Building Standards Code, as well as those relevant under the Americans with Disabilities Act. To say we not only didn't get to first base, but we didn't get out of the batter's box would be the understatement of the week. I worked in local government for 34 years and worked very closely with local building officials. And you are absolutely right. They are a tremendous resource, and they are all frustrated as hell about what's going on. I honestly think you have a thankless job. And it's interesting you're down to four commissioners. The members of the commission when I was a part, and I consider myself the exception, we either had radicals or we had ultra-conservatives. And as we're finding out in Congress, when you've got that combination, there's no way to reach compromise. A couple of the current members of the commission that you have now representing the disability community really don't know and understand disability access and have no interest or intention of reaching out to the business community. So as I say, I wish you all the luck in the world. I think you have a task, thanks to 1608, which is almost impossible to get your arms around. It's a tremendous responsibility, and I hope I'm still alive to see the commission meet most of those responsibilities. Thanks.
Thank you, Mitch, and it's a pleasure to meet you. I've just gotten finished we've just completed a report that's due on Monday to the legislature that outlines the commission's successes and, frankly, failings since its inception as well. And so, having read all the minutes and the agenda and interviewing folks along the line, I'm clearly aware of the past of the commission and the folks that were involved. I'd mentioned the commission's role as being a unique opportunity. It's the first thing of its type that I think I've ever seen that provides some opportunity for this contentious dialogue that's occurred over the last 50 years to actually, you know, find some sort of a safe place and hopefully to resolve some issues. You're right. It will involve the right kind of people. It will involve a strong staff, you know, and hopefully I have the energy my age to make it too, because what I think about this dialogue and this unique opportunity is that we have to put in as much effort as we can into changing our methodology if we're really going to make California accessible. And it's not just simply about litigation. As I said, the core of every one of those lawsuits is a real problem. But the problem with litigation is it doesn't necessarily provide for a more accessible California in the outcome. So what do we do to do that, and what role can the commission play? And I think the role the commission plays is with the right individuals, with the right leadership, and with support from the legislature, we can change the dialogue somewhat and start to provide some kind of support for business owners, local government, and others in a different manner than we have in the past. Will it work? You know, this is an experiment in many respects, and I'm, you know, as I said, I've had a life of involvement with these issues. I've been an architect for almost 40 years now, and the needle hasn't moved very much. When I was state architect, you know, the Sacramento City and County of Sacramento built a new building for the state of California. And even before it opened, you know, I noted there were issues. I sent my staff in to evaluate it. There were 3,000 violations. And so this is a very, very complex issue. And there are a lot of guns and spears raised on both sides, all sides of the issue. But at the very center, there's a sweet spot in this issue, and that is people really, truly, genuinely care about this issue and are trying to do better. And somewhere along the line, we'll have to figure out if it's at all possible to set aside some of the weapons and actually talk to each other. And that's, I think, what the commission represents as an opportunity. So I'll do my best, and I thank you for wishing me well.
Okay, does one person want to ask a last question, very brief? And this is the last one.
Well, he was first.
Go ahead.
Are you sure?
Go ahead.
My question was in regards to, my question was in regards to your, you had mentioned private sector, and you were making recommendations on remodeling. I didn't know if any of those recommendations or standards had to deal with theaters and the telecommunications, SEC accessibility for descriptive audio.
Yes, Will. You know, and to be honest with you, I've been there a couple of months, and the past commission had not gotten to that yet. But in talking to the members of the legislature that I've been talking to, and learning the history, and reaching out to several other folks, it's really clear that there's a shortcoming in that area. So we're taking a look at all the electronic stuff, theaters. They're all public accommodations. They're not, you know, in many cases, not distinctly bricks and mortar. But that's, you know, really what's happened to the environment we all enjoy now. It's moved a great deal from, you know, this whole notion that everything happens in a building to now everything, lots of stuff that we need to have access to happens online, you know, from government services all the way to, you know, entertainment issues and others. So, yeah, we'll be taking a look at that. We haven't quite gotten into it yet, but it's certainly on our radar. Can we just hear the one last question
okay.
here? Okay. Yes, I do.
Thank you. I certainly associate myself with Mitch's comments. I will add, though, that I am impressed with you, Alex, in terms of your energy and initiative. Whether it'll be enough is an open question, but I think it's certainly a step in the right direction. I know that the commission is undertaking a planning process.
Yes.
Will that planning process involve a survey of the community in terms of delineating some of the issues that the community feels should be undertaken by the commission in the long term?
Yeah, I think it has to. You know, what I've talked about is establishing a context for the planning process that all sides that are represented by the commission can wrap their hands around and take forward. I think that's been one of the issues for a long time. That's why I mentioned the stereotypes in my beginning part of my talk, because depending on where you are and where you sit in this issue, everyone has sort of a different perspective about what this is about. And so creating that common context through survey, interviews, or whatever, to me is going to be critically important to make sure it's a productive effort.
Thank you very much. Let's give Steve.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming.
And I'll give you a call, okay?
Yeah, please. And later on, after we finish, if anyone would like one of his cards, I do have them here. Okay. We have several representatives from the elevator industry here. And if they could move up, I have not had an opportunity to speak with them, so I'm not too certain who's all here. So I think I believe there's enough seats for everyone.
Yes, there are.
Okay. And after everyone has settled, I think what I'd like to do is ask if everyone would please identify themselves. This is a panel that we've put together for an update on destination dispatched elevators. And you may recall 5 years ago, we had a presentation from industry advocates, and there's been a lot of development, including the passage of a ordinance in San Francisco that is probably one of the few, if not the only, guidelines for the destination elevators. And the California State Architect's Office has included some provisions into the most recently, the 2013 building code, and is wanting to start convening meetings to further the development of these requirements for access. And we've invited several individuals to come, and if they could please identify themselves, the company they represent. Yeah. Start with that first.
Good morning. My name is Nikki Solero. I actually work for
Do you have a microphone down there?
Let's try that again. Good morning. I'm Nikki Solero. I actually am here representing Schindler Elevator Corporation.
Good morning. Joe Armis representing Otis Elevator Company.
My name is Ed Persico representing ThyssenKrupp Elevator Company.
Brandon Castillo representing Kone Elevator Company.
While we're all setting up here, we have devices. We're going to speak a little bit about the progression of destination dispatch elevators compared to conventional elevators, and Nikki will do that in just a moment. We've all brought devices for you to interact with after we are done with our brief introductions. So we'll invite you up to the table if you choose to see what these devices feel like, and be here available to answer any questions. So, Nikki?
So let's start out with an easy question. How many of you have heard about destination dispatch? Yes, that's good. So I thought what I'd start out with is just, we'll just have a little conversation about the whole technology, the whole, why do we do destination dispatch. Probably over the past 20 years now since the first destination system was installed out in Indianapolis. And just to try and understand the concept a little bit, the way a conventional elevator system works, you press a button in the hallway, okay, and you're telling the system, do I want to go up or do I want to go down? What the system doesn't know is where your final destination happens to be. So it's going to send an elevator, one elevator, to whatever floor you happen to be standing on with the intention of going in the direction that you just asked it to go into. Okay? Then you get inside, and then you press the button as to what floor you want to go to. Maybe you're the only one in the elevator. Maybe there's 10 other people in the elevator with you. Okay, so maybe you're stopping once, maybe you're stopping twice. Maybe you're the poor guy up on top who's stopping 10 times. Okay? Then let's take another step back. Maybe there were 20 people in the elevator lobby with you. Okay, so maybe you got in the elevator, maybe you didn't. But if you didn't get in the elevator, you actually have to wait for that one that just came to pick everybody else up to leave before you call another one. Okay? Well, with a destination-based system, everyone is actually telling the elevator where they want to go before they get inside the elevator. Okay? So the idea is if there happens to be 20 people in the lobby, well, then the system knows. okay? And it's going to try and group people going to like destinations or close destinations in the same elevator. And if it needs to send five cars, it's going to send five cars. If it needs to send two, it'll send two, okay? And the whole idea is, since it knows where everybody is and where everybody wants to go, you're going to get to your destination much faster and much more efficiently than you do by just pressing the up and down button. And as time has gone on, you know, the concept is catching on. We're all trying to build these giant superstructures. You know, what's the latest one? 100 and something stories. You need to figure out a way to move people as quickly as possible and as efficiently as possible to make these types of buildings possible. So each elevator manufacturer now has a destination system. They all operate pretty similarly. There are some obvious differences. Each elevator company has a different system and has a different brain, but the general concept is exactly the same in the operation. The general operation is exactly the same. Okay, so what we decided we'd like to do today, it was great that we got invited back, to let you actually come and try out our new and latest technology. As I said before, I work for Schindler. Okay, so we have what's called the Port Technology System. That's the name of our destination-based system right now. Okay, and we have introduced, we not only have a keypad, a 10-decade style keypad, but we also have introduced a touchscreen. Okay, and the idea of how it works is you walk up to the input device, whether it's a keypad or whether it's a touchscreen, and there is a button located on the screen or above the screen, and it has the raised or the wheelchair symbol on it, and it also has a braille. And when you press that button, it actually activates some assistance features. Okay, so it'll start to talk to you. Okay, it'll say, this group of elevators serves whatever the floors happen to be, floors 1 through 10. And it'll say, please press the button when you hear your destination. Okay, and it'll recite the floors that are available to you. And when you hear the floor that you want to go to, you press the button again. And the other part about the destination system is every elevator has a letter designation. Okay, so it'll actually say back to you, floor 4, car A. And then we're going to say to the left or to the right. And the idea is now that these elevator systems are, we call them smart elevators, which is awful lot like your smart phones now. It knows, okay? It knows where you are. It knows what device you're standing in front of. And it knows which elevator is located right next to the device you happen to be standing in front of. So the system is smart enough to give you the elevator that is right next to where you happen to be inputting your destination. Okay? And then, when the elevator gets to you, doors are going to open, okay? And inside the car, it's actually going to, again, say, this is car A. And it's going to say the doors are open, or opening. They're going to open a little bit slower. Okay, we are assuming that maybe you need a little bit more time to get into the elevator, which is why you press the button. Or maybe you need a little bit more space inside the elevator. Okay, so it's going to try to make sure that the car is somewhat empty or empty, so that it's no problem getting in and out. And then once you're in the elevator, destination-based systems, there's no buttons inside anymore, okay, since you already told the elevator where you want to go. So again, it's then going to speak to you as you go to your destination. It'll say the floor, and when it gets to the floor, it'll again say, floor 4, doors opening. And it's going to leave the doors open a little bit longer, again, assuming that you probably need a little bit more time to get in and out of the elevator. Again, like I said, most of the elevator companies, it's very similar operation. I just went through the basics of Schindler. So what we'd like to do is let the other gentlemen here explain the differences with their systems. And again, when we're done, we'll let you actually come on up and go ahead and play with them for a little bit, okay?
No. The speakers.
Gene, you okay?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Okay. My name is Ed Persico again. I'm with ThyssenKrupp. In front of you, you have the four major elevator companies, worldwide elevator companies. So it's likely that you're going to see what the standard of these types of devices are for all installations in major buildings. What I wanted to tell you was that I agree with Nikki. There are very few differences from one device to the next, and it's our intent as an industry to make them as close to one another in operation, in interface, in human interface, as possible, so there's not much of a variance in the way you call an elevator in a crowded lobby. The biggest concern that we had and the biggest intent that we had as an industry was to make sure that your navigation, that your path of travel once you entered a public crowded lobby way, was to get you to your destination as easily and quickly as possible. And destination dispatch elevators now will serve that purpose much more readily than conventional up and down button type of elevators. And Nikki was kind enough to explain that the up and down buttons are really kind of a chaotic situation in a crowded lobby. For those who go into buildings on a regular basis, going in the up direction and trying to find that car, if you're low-sighted or no-sight, trying to find that elevator can be a challenge with a lot of people in that lobby way. So we've devised, as an industry, to provide access to an elevator that's adjacent to that call station so you don't have to walk 40 feet to the right behind you or 30 feet to the left in front of you to find where that lantern or that gong went off to get into an elevator that literally sometimes 10 to 20 people are trying to get into the same elevator. So that's our overall intent, is to make path of travel much easier for all people. And we've devised methods that take cars out of group operation and assign adjacency either to the right or to the left of that hall station for low-sighted or blind people to make it easier to navigate to their floor. So I guess without saying what the attributes of our device is, you'll see that shortly, but essentially that's what the industry is trying to achieve.
Thanks, Ed. My name is Joe Armis with Otis Elevator Company. And just to, you know, add to what Nikki and Ed was talking about, with the destination systems, a lot of the work that was done in San Francisco with Gene and the Access Appeals Commission to create the AB090, which was, you know, the only existing regulation right now for destination-based systems, what wasn't included as part of that was the use of touch screens. And with the advancement of technology and the proliferation of smartphones and those types of devices, a lot of the companies have offered touchscreen devices as an alternate interface than a regular standard keypad. And basically what the devices are up here are a touchscreen variation for each of the major companies. And what Nikki alluded to with the ADA button assigned with the touchscreen, that's really the interface that we've all developed to allow users to use a touchscreen and to be accessible for everybody. So unless there's any other questions from the audience going forward, or Brandon, did you want to – I'll let Brandon from Kone speak.
Brandon Castillo from Kone Elevators, and we kind of hit on it going back to this button. Americans with Disability Act is what pretty much governs accessibility from the point that you enter in a building to the point where you exit it. That code does affect elevators as well and our functionality. Right now, there is no standard whatsoever, aside from the one that's being developed in San Francisco with AB090, that deals specifically with touchscreen when it comes to elevators. Now, I even see some people with smartphones here with touchscreens, whether it be a phone or a tablet. trying to bring that into standardization within elevator products is what we're trying to do today. As it stands today, there's heavy regulations on what we consider buttons. To replace buttons with the screen, and how do we discern what is, you know, tactically a button, that's what we're trying to develop. It's still quite unclear today, and what we're trying to do is come to that standardization, and hopefully, you know, progress from this meeting, we can begin to understand, okay, does the button we have today truly work, or what type of feedback can you offer that will help us to standardize as an industry something that those dealing with accessibility concerns going forth will have a seamless interface between elevators and people.
Would you hand Gene the Gene, why don't you take the microphone, the wireless one here? We can answer questions before anybody gets out of their seat.
Yeah. Whoops. Sorry. What I wanted to see if you could maybe explain a little bit on your touchscreens, I know you're going to show, but see if you could verbally kind of describe the process that you might do, or how it's accessible. You know, like, is there any markings on the screen so that you can help locate it, or is there a template? Just if you could give us a little bit of that before you start answering questions, and then we'll let people come up after the questions. Is that...
So this is something where, and you'll see from design to design, where this button exists within our fixtures, something that we'd like to get clarified even within the code agencies, where to find this button. Today, with a keypad version, you can identify easily what is a keypad and how to operate it. By operating the keypad, you look for the 5, the raised dot, and then from there you know where everything else is. It's different with the touchpad, trying to find the limits of where the touchscreen ends and where the button begins. With most of our devices, you'll find that would either be located on the top or on the bottom. It's always going to be using the accessibility devices that you're looking for, the accessibility, the wheelchair symbol, and the equilateral dots that represent accessibility. So as you come up to our devices, that's something that you'll notice. You'll be able to find the Braille dots, and you'll be able to view the accessibility button as well.
One thing I wanted to mention is that all these fixtures are capable of speaking. They have speech patterns that can direct you to identify what floor that you're going to. So for those who cannot see the device or would have trouble seeing the device, these one-button solutions will verbally direct you to select your destination. And that is done right in the hallway when you enter the facility, and you're looking to go to your floor. So that seems to be, that one-button solution seems to be the audible version that's pretty uniform across all of the devices.
The other thing that's probably important to explain is the button itself. There is contrast. You know, we all are sticking with, you know, the requirements of having the actual wheelchair symbol have a distinct contrast between the background. It is a raised symbol with the Braille so that, you know, you can feel both. As far as where, again, these fixtures are mounted in the exact location that you would find the up and down button. It's not like we move them around. They're in the same spot. And the height. Okay, the button, whether it's on above the screen or below the screen, is mounted within the requirements of the 42 to 48 inches. Okay, so that has not changed. So not only are they in the same spot, they're at the same height as where you would normally find the buttons. I would like, you know, pretty much everybody's system, you press button and it starts to talk to you. Again, the announcement might not be exactly the same from one company to the next, but the concept is the same. Okay? And obviously it's for various reasons, the way things were developed and the way each company designs their product. But like I said, the concept is the same, and that's why we thought today would be great for you to come and try them out and give us some feedback. But before we do that, we would like to open it up to questions. We're positive you have questions, so.
Hi, I'm Louis from Southern California. While I've been researching touchscreen technology for quite a while, especially in the area of consumer-oriented products, and elevators is that same type of technology, there's two concerns that I have, and I've been in many buildings where the acoustics are so bad that for a blind person to try and orient themselves to where the audio is coming from or going in a direction, is there going to be some sort of environmental noise sensor that can augment the volume as required when there's a large crowd, or are we going to be stuck waiting for the crowd to disappear so that we can hear where the elevator is? That's one question. My other question is, are you using any type of haptic feedback for those that want to use the touchscreen that move from one button to another or from one location to another? Will there be any type of haptic feedback to give us an indication that we have moved to another option within the screen?
This is Joe Armas from Otis. I'll address it from the technology standpoint. Certainly with the automatic gain control, I guess, for the speech has been discussed. It is being looked at. I know at least in our company, I'm sure everybody's looked at that because we've all sat in those same situations, is because, as you know, those lobbies can vary in different volumes, especially main lobbies of buildings. So there's certainly work going on to look into that technology and incorporating it into these elevator fixtures. As far as the haptic feedback, again, is these devices are meant to be used for a very long period of time in buildings and over multiple times, incorporating some of that technology it takes time for us to do. And we are aware of it from an industry standpoint. But I think I can speak for Otis. To this day, like today, we don't have a haptic feature on our touchscreens.
Speaking for Schindler, this is new technology for all of us. So as touchscreens and the technology comes along, we're all trying to find the most effective and efficient screens out there, ones that can stand up to the abuse. You know, that's something we all need to think about, too. We want these to last. We don't want them to fail. That doesn't help any of us. We're all, as we've gone in, we've worked out different things. These topics have come up with a lot of our designers, which actual feedback from people like yourselves, all of us at this panel, go back to our designers and say, hey, we're not making this up. This is something that we really should be looking into.
I guess to answer the question you had with regards to the level of volume that these audible devices can deliver, the ABA requires the 20 decibels over ambient average in that lobby way. And the problem that we face is how do you establish that average ambient noise? It's different for different periods of a day, and it's also different for each type of lobby way. Sometimes you have small lobbies with only two or three cars, four cars in it, and other times you have a bank of eight elevators in a marble lobby way where ambient noise is just very... It's very difficult to discern the instructions from a keypad. So presently what we're doing is we're regulating volume at that device. If you're standing in front of the device and you were to activate the button,
press button when you hear desired floor, or press twice to cancel. 3. Press twice to floor number 5. Please proceed to elevator A. First elevator to your left front.
So sorry about that. I didn't put the microphone next to it. When you're closer to the device, being in front of it, you can hear it a lot more readily than if you're across the room. And obviously, if you're looking to get an elevator, you're standing in front of that device. So when you come up here to actually use it, we think that's probably going to be a little bit more discernible. Second question.
This is Joe Xavier from the Department of Rehabilitation. I have a couple of questions for you. And just hearing the device going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, how long does it take to get to 100? And then the other question would be, are the touch screens in use? And if not, when do you anticipate and what approvals do you need for the touch screen to be used?
All right, to answer your first question, I don't think there's an elevator available to the public that goes from one floor to 100. They typically are broken down into different rises. So a low rise will service floors 1 through 10. The mid-rise may service 10 through 22 and high-rise, you know, on and on. But it's typical for any elevator bank to service an average of 10 to 12 floors. Are you waiting a little bit longer? You are. If it's going through verbal commands, you're going to need to sequence or somehow jump through those floors to get to your floor. But it is not, you're not going to be standing in front of the device waiting for it to count from 1 to floor 90, because elevator lobbies are not designed that way. So did I answer that question? Is anybody? Yeah? Okay. And the second question was, from an architectural standpoint, how are they regulated?
So are the touch pads in use now? If not, when do you anticipate for them to be in use, and what approvals do you need to use a touch pad versus the raised buttons?
Touchpads are in use today, and they are available in San Francisco. I believe we have some in Sacramento? San Jose. They are becoming more and more installed, especially in the high-rise commercial market. There are requirements as far as touchscreen is concerned. There is stress ratio. There is static background as opposed to any motion background to make it easier to see for low vision. People, the contrast between the background and the actual key, the symbol of the floor number on the screen has to be a certain dimension, which is in compliance with the existing ADA dimensional requirements on a regular elevator, physical regular elevator button. The devices that have touchscreens on them now are presently accompanied, at least in San Francisco, by a keypad, which is a telephone keypad, but in all other areas of the country, that is not required. San Francisco is the only municipality that requires the keypad in addition to the touchscreen. Almost all other installations across the country are going towards touchscreen only with the single accessibility button verbal command. I hope I answered your question.
We're streaming, so we have to be on microphones. We have people all over the world, United States, listening.
Charlene, I don't know. A lot of the mics are off. We don't know why.
Yeah, he. I think that one died, so I came up to the front because I'm close. Anyway, the announcement, it said it was the second elevator to my left. If I'm in a busy lobby, I push the button. I need to step back, and now I'm going to be moved around just by the motion of the crowd. How am I going to know where that elevator is? And how does it know that it's the second one to my left? I may have moved over just so other people could get to the button.
The actual adjacency requirement is that when you activate the accessibility button, only the elevator to your immediate left or to your immediate right will respond. The stations, the actual fixtures themselves, are aware that you are standing in front of that station. And so when it assigns an elevator to you, you only have to move to the left to get the elevator adjacent to your left, or to your right to get the adjacent elevator to your right. You're never going to be directed to turn around or to move two cars away. It's just immediate left or immediate right.
And in that immediate left, immediate right is in reference to, as Ed said, the station that you're standing in front of. And if you happen to get moved around by the crowd or whatnot, when that elevator arrives, it will announce itself that
Elevator A has arrived, doors opening, as Nikki alluded to earlier, and it'll give an extended time that those doors are open to allow you to navigate to the elevator. In addition to the verbal commands, there's also the standard hall entrance braille that's on the entranceway of each elevator will also tell you which floor you're at and what elevator it is. So if you've heard that you've been assigned elevator B, there'll be a braille piece on the entrance jamb that says it's elevator B so that you know you're actually going into the right elevator.
Yeah, my name is Robert Wendt, and I have a question about the font style that will be used. Is that just is nested in the standards, or are there standards? And if there aren't, what guidelines would you be using for that? The fonts that are used on the display screen. For a low vision individual, there are certain fonts that are really annoying. and so are there standards for those fonts?
This is Brandon Castillo with Kone. There are standards that are written today. They're the same standards that exist for our Braille. So those would be from one device to the next. What you would originally see as text requirements on your keypad is the same requirements that you would see adhered to on the touchscreen. So it all exists within our accessibility codes, the ADA, ANSI codes, as well as our building codes. So the same codes that kind of exist for existence, how do we find when an elevator is assigned to your left or to your right? There are identifiers above each elevator for Kone products. Once you've input your accessibility call, there will be a honing pinging above the elevator that you're assigned to so that it will help you to identify what direction it's coming from and how far to the left or to the right that adjacent elevator may be. Also, as well, when the doors open, it'll identify itself. So if you were assigned car B, you would immediately hear car B to your left start pinging so you could identify it. Once the doors open, it would say car B has arrived, elevators going up or down, depending upon where your destination is. So there's a number of ways for you to confirm I'm going in the right direction, and I have arrived at the correct elevator.
Let me get the last question, and then we're going to let you off the front. If you get a mic for a little
bit. Oh, thank you. Hi. Is it on? Can you hear me? Okay. I'm Julianne Harris, and I have a couple questions. My first one is there a minimum number of elevators that that you have to have to be able to fit from the dispatch system? And then I'm also wondering, the people who are hard of hearing, if you have plans of putting an audio jack, perhaps, in as part of the device for people, and that would also maybe help solve some of the noise issues. And then for the people who are deafblind, do you have any alternative options for them? Because they wouldn't be able to hear the audio to be able to use the device.
Okay. So what, we kind of alluded to what those audible requirements were, and it's 10 to 20 dB over the ambient noise. There is a maximum audio that we're allowed to actually produce, and it's 80 dB. So what you'll find with most of our devices is that we are capable of meeting 80 dB, and you can adjust those settings depending upon what environment you're in. Obviously, we don't want it to be so loud that we're really, you know, damaging somebody's hearing. So you'll see that. As far as users who are not able to see and hear, that's really a hard one to gauge. With Kone products, we offer touchscreens with both keypad and non-keypad versions. What we would recommend on that would be to have that keypad version. However, it would be almost impossible for us to serve the needs using destination dispatch as well as even a conventional system, because you would not know when the elevator has arrived. Regardless of whether you're inputting it using our destination dispatching or conventional operations.
Yes, I have a comment and a question. The comment is, well, actually, it's more of a question. When you are standing in a bank of four elevators, and you're between elevators 1 and 2, A and B, and elevators C and D are going to the 4 that I want, does that mean that I have to wait to the system reprograms elevators A or B to take me to where I need to be instead of alerting me to move 2 elevators over or 3 elevators over? That's the number one question. My second question is, given the technology has progressed, and I think it's MAD elevators that I was researching at one time, they were using something similar to an iPad or an Android device to allow for accessibility for persons with various degrees of disabilities. This is something that can be implemented because the technology is here, just like haptic technology is being used by cell phone users to let us know when we are moving from one button to the other. So this haptic technology could be easily implemented to make the experience of navigating touchscreen technology much easier. But my question basically is this. Is it possible to integrate some sort of a Bluetooth transceiver that would allow a device like assistive technology for persons who are deafblind or persons who may have severe hearing loss that can integrate with their assistive listening device or a Bluetooth hearing aid to give us that kind of a functionality to continue to be independent?
This is Joe from Otis. In regards to the MAD fixtures and MAD devices that you were talking about with the touchscreen, and utilizing and leading that towards some sort of Bluetooth integration for deafblind and folks with a smartphone that help them use. It's probably safe to say that, I mean, a lot of our companies are looking at wireless transmission to allow users to be able to interface with these destination systems through a smartphone device or some sort of communication. That's a big push. That's a big area of focus for at least for Otis to be able to utilize that for users who have to rely on their phone, who have the existing technology on their phone today to help them navigate, to be able to integrate that with fixtures. We're not there yet. Obviously, there's a lot of testing that has with the elevator systems. There's a lot of other communications that occur. And with those MAD fixtures, what they are doing is a touchscreen COP for a conventional system. And typically, they've also included a physical keypad inside the elevator as well to help give the tactile for ADA users. But that company has not, as far as I'm aware, have incorporated anything into a destination-based interface with at least Otis. And I don't know if, Nikki, if you have anything else to add.
Just to add into that, I could tell you that Schindler has introduced some phone apps over in Europe and are currently testing to see how well they work. The whole concept is it doesn't matter. Everybody's got a smartphone. They walk in, and the system will pick you up, and you, based upon your predetermined, destination, like you always go to the same floor in the office every day, then the phone will respond back to you with a little text message or audio message that says "Carre." So the technology's out there. It's just between what type, whether it's Bluetooth or whether it's Wi-Fi or whether it's NFC. It's kind of like the beta VHS CD type thing, which way the technology is actually going to go to make it as useful for everybody as possible. So we're working on it.
Okay. I want to thank our representatives from the various companies for coming, and thank you. Okay. For coming, and let's give them a hand, and now they are at the head table at the front of the room, so to the right, so just please come up and line up and take turns there, and I'm just going to say to the representatives, I'm going to leave the room, but I'll come back in a few minutes. I want to take a look at the equipment, too.